Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in our life. Recently, the Australian cricket team pulled out of a series of matches against Afghanistan in protest over the ruling Taliban's restrictions on women and girls' education and employment. Sport and politics colliding. Broken promises, maybe. A breach of trust from the Taliban government, maybe. And an attempt by the cricketers to raise awareness and bring about change. But how effective can this be, and can politics be helped by what happens in sport? To help me play keepy uppy with all of these questions, I am delighted to be joined by writer and broadcaster Mihir Bose. Hello, Mihir.
Hello, Lucy. How are you?
I'm really well, and fantastic to have you on my couch, as they say. What did you make, first off, with that decision in the last week or so by Australia Cricket? Did it come as a bit of a surprise? Will it have any impact?
It came as a surprise. I don't think it'll have an impact. I have seen this process of how sport has become part of the political situation for a long time. If you look back at the history of sport, it was the dictators, Hitler and Mussolini, who understood the power of sport, and they promoted it. Hitler in the 36 Olympics, Mussolini with the World Cups, which Italy before the war won. In fact, Mussolini was almost the team manager in some ways. I think this has grown more recently. And I look back on white South Africa, apartheid regime, which for a long time was allowed to dictate to the rest of the world who they would play and who these nations, even the white nations that they played with, could select and so on before South Africa was excluded. What is important to mention, and South Africa is often mentioned, what is important to mention there is what South Africa did other countries don't do, which is they said, we are only going to play certain countries and who these countries can select. What is now happening is the power of sport to try and influence decisions, partly because the political nations are using it to promote sport. And we saw that with the Qatar World Cup. We are seeing it with the Saudis in golf and so on. The point is, how far can sport go? I think sport's power to influence events is limited, but sport can be used, certainly. If sport is being used to promote a regime, then something ought to be done about it. But how do you define what is a promotion of a regime becomes a very difficult thing. And therefore, if you go into, I don't think it'll have any impact on Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a different situation. I don't think, the Australian cricketers will certainly feel better for having done that, for having taken a stance. But in terms of impact, it'll have no impact. For the impact to take place, it has to come from the political governments. And the question is whether the Australian cricketers' step can influence the Australian government to do something. And I doubt it. Australian government's decision will be dictated by geopolitical considerations of various kinds.
Yes, and Afghanistan will be fairly low down on the list of Australian government priorities, I guess. But you're right to have highlighted the Football World Cup in November, because in advance, people were saying, well, will this see a change? Will it mean that people on the ground having access to fans from all over the world coming into their country and maybe behaving slightly differently, will it change anything? Do you think we saw any of that in November?
No. I don't think so. I was there at the headquarters of FIFA in Zurich when they took the decision to go to Qatar. They took the decision at the same time as they took the decision for Russia. And what is interesting is obviously the Qatar decision came as a complete surprise. But all the focus was on Russia getting it, because England were bidding and England only got two votes and were quickly bundled out. And Prince William had gone, David Cameron had gone. There was a joke that if Prince William gave wedding invitations to the FIFA executive committee members, they would vote for England, which was a stupid idea. FIFA executive committee members are pretty ruthless people who look after their interests. And in fact, much of that executive has since gone. But the point is that at that stage, nobody looked at Qatar's human rights record and so on. That became a subject much later. And of course, Qatar used it to promote itself. Qatar wanted the World Cup because that was an instrument it used to try and lever itself up, given that it is in a region where its great rival is Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabians are now coming into golf in a big way. And, you know, that's if you like, political rivalry. But the problem there is that organizations like FIFA and the IOC are run by people who see themselves as not running a sporting organization, but running a mini state. And they promote this idea that sport can do wonders. Yes, sport has great qualities. I'm a sports fan. When my team wins, I feel wonderful, and things like that. But who is
your team here? I mean, do they win very often?
At the moment, they don't win very often. My football team is Tottenham Hotspur, and they're up and down season. But the point is, when they do win, when they won the other day, I know it was fairly late at night by the time they won. I went to bed feeling very happy, looking forward to reading the next day's papers and so on. But I don't think we should exaggerate the impact of sport. Sport has lots of qualities, and sport is showing in some ways how it can, for instance, make greater headway in promoting racial equality and that sort of thing. But the idea that it can change national policy, is it wrong? Qatar was not going to change. Qatar was going to use it to promote it. And we saw it at the end when the cup was won by Argentina. A Arab dress was put round Messi, the captain of Argentina, as if to promote Qatar. You know, this was meant to show the world this is Qatar, and Qatar wasn't going to change in any way, and it was wrong for us to think so. I mean, I followed the World Cup because I think football can still be a wonderful sport. It is a wonderful sport, but I had no illusions about where Qatar would go or how Qatar would behave with its migrant labors, which of course is dreadful.
Although actually, I, in terms of the impact on policy, I did read only this week that Cristiano Ronaldo has obviously gone now to play in Saudi Arabia, as you say, Qatar's great rival, and he's being allowed to live with his partner even though they're not married. So the government
I think Lucy, in little bits, those changes can be allowed because, you know, they've paid a lot of money. They want to promote Cristiano Ronaldo. They're going to use him in advertisements in Saudi Arabia and things like that. So I think those are minor changes. Basic fundamental policy changes will take a long time. If it comes in Saudi Arabia, I have my doubts. And even in Qatar, I mean, I think it's in today's papers. The migrant laborers who built the stadiums have now been thrown out of their job. They will have to go back to the country they came from. So I think these things will go on. And I think political powers will take decisions about friendship with Qatar or Saudi Arabia on their interests, you know. I mean, sport is used because sport is seen as a weapon which nobody can object to. And sport, of course, the thing about sport is that sport can bridge nations in the way a culture like music or arts cannot. You know, the Western music is very different to Indian music. And people who follow Indian music don't actually find Western music easy or simple. And similarly, those brought up in Western music don't find Indian or Chinese music that simple. Whereas sport, if you know the rules, if you know, for instance, in football, the offside rule, you will basically be able to follow the game. And because sport is based on rule-based things,
I'm trying to improve on that note. I'm trying to improve my understanding of the American football rules, and it's interesting how complicated it is if you perhaps haven't grown up with something that actually. But you're right, from an activity that goes beyond language and therefore is, you know, very about the visual, and you can see, you know, there are shared elements of it, like resilience and triumph over adversity, and the narrative of, you know, being the underdog but winning. That those are stories that people can really connect to, and maybe that's what politicians often try, why they try to harness sport for their own ends, to kind of appear relatable or to piggyback off sporting success.
Yeah, and that has grown in recent years. That has dramatically increased. So you had David Cameron claiming to support a football club whose sporting colours he didn't know. You know, this is something that, you know, you want to be associated with it. You want to feel that you are one of the man of the people. You know, and in a way, that to a certain extent is worrying, because you want a true sporting fan. You don't want somebody jumping on the bandwagon, but a lot of that has happened, and it can't be prevented. Because the other thing about sport that has happened, and I've seen it in the nearly 50 years I've been covering sport as a journalist, is that when I was young, to see a sports match, you had to buy a ticket, you know, and that is how you saw it. Now, sport is on television. You don't have to go to a match. In fact, the sporting authorities get more money from television and marketing than they get from people who are in the stands. And therefore, there is, if you like, this disconnect between sport that is played on the field of play and what sport is watched by the people, often at home or in pubs and things like that. Excuse me, sorry.
But also it's got this incredible global reach. I remember I went on a boat up the Irrawaddy River in Myanmar to an incredibly remote village. And there were three children in the village wearing Manchester City shirts. Mm. And they were able to talk to us in great depth about the team and the season they were having, and what went, and it was probably helped by the fact that Manchester United were actually playing that week, I think, and it was being broadcast. But suddenly you're having a conversation with people with whom you ought to have very little in common, but sport brings you together.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in India, in Mumbai, before I came to this country, and I fell in love with Tottenham Hotspur because of the coverage that we had of British sport in the Indian papers. But that was based on newspapers, so the results would often come a day late because of time differences and so on. But now it's instant. It's, you know, you can see it immediately. It goes around the world. Social media means people are commenting, things like that. And as you said, you'll find kids in hilly areas of India, leading to the Himalayas, wearing all sorts of shirts in Mumbai Airport, which is now a much more modern airport than the ramshackle one that I knew as a child. There's a huge Manchester United shop, and it will advertise Manchester United versus Liverpool matches. I think that is what has happened. And that, if you like, has formed a language between people. I hardly know a word of Spanish apart from Ole, but I'd like to think I can follow the moves that Messi makes or any other Spanish player makes. You know, I think that is the bridge. But I think we should be careful about not exaggerating the political impact of this, because I think if we do that, and that is what leads to situations like Qatar or even the World Cup in Russia, you can fall into the trap that you're giving politicians a handle to use sport for their own purposes. As I said, I was at Zurich when that decision was made. And it was very interesting. Russia was bidding against England. Putin had said on the day of the bid that he wasn't going to come because he didn't want to disturb and affect the FIFA executive members. I mean, that was just a trick pulled by him. But then he flew in the moment it came. And I asked him a couple of questions at the press conference. And one of them was about human rights in Russia, and he brushed it aside. And the other one was about who would pay for it. And Roman Abramovich was in the front row at the press conference, who was then owner of Chelsea, and he looked at Abramovich and said, he's a rich man. And, you know, Abramovich smiled and he smiled and things like that. And, you know, Putin used that. And Putin, incidentally, spoke in English. Putin used that to promote Russia. People forget the 2018 World Cup that took place was a promotion of Russia. It reached out. And a lot of people didn't care a damn about what the situation in Russia was or what Putin's rule was or regime was. And if we are going to go to various countries, and sports should go around the world, let us not pretend that by taking football or other sports to these countries, we are going to change those countries. We are going to highlight those countries. Yes, Qatar's human rights is now, if you like, on the front pages. It was the agenda subject. People discussed it. Had the World Cup not gone there, it wouldn't have been discussed. But the question is, next time Qatar is doing a deal with Britain, will the British Foreign Secretary raise the question about human rights with Qatar? I doubt it. You know, he will say, what is the interest of Britain in having this deal with Qatar? Will it actually help jobs in Britain?
Although you do have a lot of faith in the power of sport to have other impact, tell me a bit about your theory that it could create, as you referenced earlier in this conversation, this non-racial world.
Yes, I've written a book called Dreaming the Impossible, How Sport Can Create a Non-Racial World. And what I see sport as bringing people together at the individual level, and I've seen this in football. When I started covering football for the Sunday Times back in 1978, no black player had played for England. Viv Anderson was the first. He came along a short time later, and I would go to matches, and I would be often not only the only non-white face in the press box, but often the only non-white face in the stadium, and this team itself, both teams, the 22 players on the field would be all white. Now, if you look at the England team, it is a very, very multicultural, multiracial team, and that team is accepted by the England fans. Nobody sort of raises the question. Whereas back in the 70s, there was a lot of question, could the black players play? Would they be strong enough? Would they be mentally able to cope with English football and all that sort of thing? And people high up in the game raised these questions. Now, of course, nobody would raise that. And I think that, and of course, what is interesting is players from all over the world are playing. And it's very interesting. Religion has come into football. You see these players from other parts of the world. And the moment they come on the field, they cross themselves. You know, when I started following football, I didn't ever see a player cross himself when he came on football. I don't think anybody took the name of Jesus before he kicked a ball, but now they are taking the name of Jesus. And given that the church's membership is falling, maybe the Archbishop of Canterbury should look into it and recruit some footballers into his ranks.
So Justin Welby, if you are listening, or while you're listening, do make a note of getting in touch with Mihir Bose. I mean, I think you're right, but there was, don't forget, quite a lot of hostility when some of the England players of colour missed penalties in the Euros back in a couple of years ago. That actually, it's not been a smooth journey, and it still isn't a smooth journey, even in a racially tolerant country like the UK.
No, it is not an easy journey. It is a difficult journey. And obviously, those comments were made on social media and things like that. And let's recognize it. There is racism in this country. That doesn't make this a racist country, let me emphasize. There are people who are racist, and probably they will always be racist. We can't get out of that. But the acceptance and also the way Gareth Southgate, a white man who would have had not much experience of black people before he started playing football, the way he has responded, the way he has put the team together, I think is a shining example of how people from very different backgrounds can come together. Which was, and I think, Lucy, the other factor that people miss, particularly in this country, is how much of a class factor there is. You know, we talk of race, and of course there is race, but you know, there is a big class factor. And to give you an example, in cricket, until the 1960s, there was gentlemen versus players. Players were people who were paid, and there were gentlemen were the people who played for the fun of it. they had, well, most of them had jobs in the city, stockbrokers and things like that. And the players never captained England. It was only the gentlemen who captained England. And they had separate dressing rooms and things like that. So, you know, we have moved. And it's very interesting. Now, again, this was a time when there was much in-your-face racism in this country. But if the England or the West Indian team came as visitors, they were actually in the gentlemen's dressing room and not the players' dressing room. So, you know, I mean, the complexities of this, and this is where I think barriers within society are breaking down. If you're a supporter of a team and that is winning, and that team's success is due to black players, then you will not care about the color of the skin. You'd want your team to win, and I think that factor has come in, as opposed to what it was, when I was young, and of course what used to take place in South Africa and other parts of the world. I mean, remember, if you look back at history. Jackie Robinson became the first black player to play Major League Baseball in 1947. You know, and in America then, they had a different league, what they call the so-called Negro League, because, you know, black players played separately. So 47 is okay, it's a long time, it's more than 70 years, but nevertheless, it is not that long ago, and certainly as we talk about football and other sport, the integration that has come has been, in my opinion, quite remarkable.
I guess it's interesting just to think about the power that money plays in all of this, because you referenced earlier the LIV golf tour in Saudi Arabia. We've got the IPL in India, which is notoriously awash with cash. And there's been quite a lot of talk this week about personal finances for certain politicians, that actually money is kind of percolating underneath a lot of this, isn't there?
Oh, yes. And I think what has happened is, in a way, there is now, and I have mentioned this in my other writings, a dysfunction that in the way sport is now played. In the old days, football particularly, there was a close connection between the football supporters, the community where they came from, and the football club. In fact, many of the players, and I mentioned it in my book, Dreaming the Impossible, many of the players after a match would go to the pub and talk to the players. Now, that doesn't happen. They will get into their Porsche and just drive away. And the gap between what the ordinary supporter earns and what the player, forget Ronaldo. Ronaldo is, of course, earning more money than Nadeem Zahawi will ever earn, probably. But who knows? I mean, I don't know. Nadeem Zahawi may kick the ball better than Ronaldo. I don't know about his about his football abilities.
So I'll try and get him on as a guest and ask him.
But the point is that, you know, the gap between what the top players earn and what the ordinary supporter earns has grown enormously. And, you know, and therefore, if you like, money dictates it, you know. And also, I think we should not forget that the sports star, however big he is always worried that his career could come to an end very suddenly because of an injury. So he wants to make as much money as he can, as soon as he can, and while he is still good enough to be playing. And of course, that is not the story with ordinary people who know that they have a long working life in order to earn enough money to survive.
Maybe that's the overlap that we had never really been thinking about, where politics and sport collide, some kind of Venn diagram where they overlap. Finally, Mihir, what do you think that, because we've talked a lot about the way that politicians can offer, or even nation states can harness sport for their own ends. But what do you think politics could learn from sport, particularly this thesis you have about creating a non-racial world, perhaps about resilience or tolerance? Do you think politics needs to, instead of trying to leech off sporting success, actually just learn from it?
I think what politics can learn from sport is, if people agree on common fundamentals, how they can live together And they can compete. And yet at the same time, at the end of it, if you see at the end of a sporting contest, and we see this very often, the players will shake hands, you know, they
swap
will often
jumpers,
embrace
swap
each other
shirts.
Or exchange jerseys. And what we are now getting is that world is disappearing. Politicians treat each other as if they are real enemies, and therefore we don't move forward because, you know, one politician and sports people can be ruthless when they're playing. Two football teams are at each other's throat, but at the end of it they still can shake hands. And I think that is what politicians need to learn, that you must have a common set of values that drive you.
Mihir Bose, writer, broadcaster, and author of Dreaming the Impossible. Thank you very much indeed for being my guest
Pleasure.
on the Couch.
Pleasure.